Welcome to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, instructor of the SBS 318 course on Islamic culture and civilization offered here at the Cal State University, coming live to you from the university on LA, channel LA 36 on cable television and worldwide on the internet. The topic for discussion tonight, session 8 of 13 sessions on Islamic culture and civilization. Tonight's session is part 1 of Islam's contribution to global civilization. Later on, I'll be having a dear guest, Munir Sheikh from UCLA, who will be joining us. But I wish to bring to your attention the fact that the topic of Islamic civilization and its contribution to the global civilization is perhaps one of the cornerstones of the program itself. And therefore, we have part one this week, and hopefully part two as a continuation next week. For our discussion today, I'll be making reference to various textbooks, but I thought I'd bring to your attention the following three that I'll specifically be referring to and recommend that you use this as a source of reference for future reading and for information. The one is the World Civilizations, the Global Experience. The other is also the Cultural Atlas of Islam, as well as Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power. Now, these are textbooks which I have referred to, amongst other textbooks, and I also feel that it will enhance your understanding of the subject, for there is a tremendous amount of information regarding this topic. Very often the students have requested more information for further reading, and these three have been the primary source of reference for today's discussion. I would like to start by making reference to a quote from one of the three books that I'll be referring to, that I've referred to, and the book is Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power. And it is by Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair. And it is a companion. There we have the three books. The Cultural Atlas of Islam, which is the one that I made tremendous amount of reference to and research from, as well as the one that I'm going to read from, the introduction by Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair, Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power. And this book is a companion to the acclaimed PBS documentary on Islam, the Empire of Faith. Islam, Empire of Faith. That is the documentary that accompanied this book, or rather, this book accompanied that documentary. Let me read for you an extract from the introduction. The horrific events of September 11th, 2001 have forever changed the way Americans view Islam and Muslims. Even before those catastrophes, most Americans at the dawn of the third millennium associated the word Islam with a range of negative images. From turbaned terrorists to stern-faced mullahs exhorting the faithful to shun the temptations of Western civilization. The ghastly picture of hijacked jetliners crashing into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, the shots of the gaping hole in the Pentagon, and all of the rubble in the Pennsylvania countryside have made things much worse. For news reports and interviews with pundits often imply that the people who did these terrible deeds acted in the name of Islam, and that Muslims are somehow essentially different from the rest of us. The constant barrage of stories about a minuscule and aberrant minority has colored American perception of faith, followed by more than 1 billion people, approximately one-fifth of the Earth's population. In the U.S., Islam is the fastest-growing religion, and there are now more American Muslims than Episcopalians. They are now us. In reality, Islam, which is only a half a dozen centuries younger than Christianity, created a long and brilliant civilization that is responsible for much of the way we are today. For example, you are reading the book on the sheet of paper, and its pages are numbered with Arabic numerals. Both of these inventions were brought to the West during the Middle Ages, thanks to Muslims. Given Islam's importance in the world today, all of us must try to approach it with more than old stereotypes. And we who wrote this book, wanted to show some of the positive aspects of Islamic civilization in its first 1,000 years. That millennium, was one in which the essential features of Islamic culture were elaborated and disseminated throughout Eurasia. Islamic civilization was preeminent, and the unities of religion, language and culture allowed people to travel with ease between the shores of the Atlantic and the Pacific, between the steppes of Central Asia and the deserts of Africa. This is a quote, of course, from the Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power by Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair, an extract from the introduction. Now, throughout my education and training, I always assumed when taught about scientific and mathematical fields such as biology, chemistry, physics, algebra, geometry and trigonometry and so on, that all knowledge that have been collated and which are taught at universities and schools and high schools somewhat are all discoveries that have been made or done by Westerners or people in Europe. They were, or seemingly they were, the achievements of people like Einstein, Galileo, Pascal, Bohr, Aristotle, Newton, Darwin, Pythagoras, and so on. People to whom the academic world and the world at large is eternally indebted. However, many groups of people have consistently been neglected in school curriculums across the world and somewhat in the Western world. And this, in some way, due to the implementation of an ethnocentric worldview. Now, although the world of Islam is viewed as being distinctly Eastern and separate from the so-called Western or European world, the Islamic world has been and still is inextricably linked with the development of the West. When we analyze the history, as we will see this evening, Muslims did not merely indulge in the task of translating Greek texts and passing them on to the European world, but the scholars critically analyzed, collated, corrected, and even supplemented substantially the Greek sciences and philosophy. And therefore, Europe somewhat owes a colossal debt to the Islamic civilization in the realm of science, particularly in the scientific attitude the Muslims developed very early in the history. Whereas the great Greeks systematized, generalized, and theorized, the Muslims were known to have established new methods of investigation, of experimentation, observation, measurement, and development that resulted in the transmission of the roots of modern-day science as we have it today from the Islamic civilization to the so-called Western or European civilization. Whereas the Western civilization was essentially European, the Islamic civilization was Asian, Middle Eastern, African, and European, and that is why it is said to have been the really a first universal civilization. The period during which Europe was shrouded by the Dark Ages, while Europe was plunged into the abyss of wilderness and obscurity, the torch of learning was kept alive in the world of Islam through the works of its scholars. Suffice it for me to quote from an extract from the CEO of Hewlett-Packard. Her name is Carly Fiorina. She's the CEO of Hewlett-Packard. And she said the following words at a seminar on the 26th of September in Minneapolis at a conference on technology, business, and our way of life. What's next? Technology, business, and our way of life. What's next? These are the words of Carly Fiorina. She said, and I quote, "There was once a civilization that was the greatest in the world. It was able to create a continental superstate that stretch from ocean to ocean and from northern climes to tropics and deserts. Within its dominion lived hundreds of millions of people of different creeds and ethnic origins. One of its languages became the universal language of much of the world, the bridge between the people of 100 lands. Its armies were made up of people of many nationalities, and its military protection allowed a degree of peace and prosperity that had never been known. The reach of this civilization's commerce extended from Latin America to China and everywhere in between. And this civilization was driven more than anything by invention. Its architects designed buildings that defied gravity. Its mathematicians created the algebra and algorithm that would enable the building of computers and the creation of encryptions. Its doctors examined the human body and found new cures for diseases. Its astronomers looked into the heavens, named the stars, and paved the way for space travel and exploration. Its writers created thousands of stories, stories of courage, romance, and magic. Its poets wrote of love when others before them were too steeped in fear to think of such things. When other nations were afraid of ideas, this civilization thrived on them and kept them alive. When censors threatened to wipe out knowledge from past civilization, this civilization kept knowledge alive and passed it on to others. While modern Western civilization shares many of these traits, the civilization I am talking about was the Islamic world from the year 800 to 1600, which included the Ottoman Empire and the courts of Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo, and enlightened rulers like Suleiman the Magnificent. Although we are often unaware of our indebtedness to this other civilizations, its gifts are very much part of our heritage. The technology industry would not exist without the contribution of Arab mathematicians. Sufi poet philosophers like Rumi challenged our notions of self and truth. Leaders like Suleiman contributed to our notions of tolerance and civic leadership. And perhaps we can learn a lesson from his example. It was leadership based on meritocracy, not inheritance. It was leadership that harnessed the full capabilities of a very diverse population that included Christianity, Islamic, and Jewish traditions. This kind of enlightened leadership that nurtured culture, sustainability, diversity, and courage, led to 800 years of invention and prosperity. In dark and serious times like this, we must affirm our commitment to building societies and institutions that aspire to this kind of greatness. This is the last words of Carly Fiorina in that quote of hers at the as the CEO of Hewlett Packard, and I'm quoting from a seminar on September 26 last year in Minneapolis at a conference or seminar on technology, business, and our way of life. What's next? The last part surely is gripping. In dark and serious times like this, we must affirm our commitment to building societies and institutions that aspire to this kind of greatness. Now, having made reference to the impact, by way of introduction, the impact of Islamic civilization and contribution, we need to analyze somewhat in detail. And in the next 6 hours, 3 hours this week and 3 hours next week, in session 8 and 9 of this SBS 318 program, we will be analyzing somewhat in detail the contributions and the contributors to this global civilization from an Islamic background. Now, Islam, as we know, is based on unity which stands against racial or ethnic discrimination. And this is very significant in understanding how Islamic civilization was able to transcend some barriers that in the past may have kept other civilizations within a particular realm and limited. Now, due to this universal approach, major religious and racial and ethnic groups, such as the Arabs, the Persians, the Turks, Africans, Indians, Chinese, and Malaysians, in addition to numerous smaller units, embraced Islam and contributed jointly to the Islamic civilization. Moreover, it must be remembered and understood very clearly from the outset that Islam was not opposed to learning from the earlier civilizations and incorporating their science, their learning, and their culture into its own worldview, as long as it did not undermine or oppose the basic principles of Islam. Each ethnic and racial group which embraced Islam made its contribution to one Islamic civilization to which all belonged. This sense of brotherhood and sisterhood was so much emphasized that it overcame all local attachments to particular tribe, race, or language, all of which became subservient to the universal brotherhood and sisterhood and universal civilization, which was Islam. Now, the global civilization thus created by Islam permitted people of diverse ethnic backgrounds to work together in cultivating various arts and sciences. Although the civilization was profoundly Islamic, even non-Muslim people of the book, specifically Christians and Jews, participated in the intellectual activity whose fruits, of course, belonged to everyone. As a result of this, the nomadic Arabs became torchbearers of science and learning. The Persians, who had created a great civilization even before the rise of Islam, nevertheless produced much more science and learning in the period under Islamic rule. The same can be said of the Turks and of Africa. The religion of Islam was itself responsible not only for the creation of a world civilization in which people of many different ethnic backgrounds participated, but it played a central role in developing intellectual and cultural life on a scale not seen before. For some 800 years, in fact, Arabic remained the major intellectual and scientific language of the academic world. During the centuries following the rise of Islam, Muslim dynasties ruling in various parts of the Islamic world bore witness to the flowering of a culture and thought that contributed to a global civilization. In fact, the tradition of intellectual activity was eclipsed only at the beginning of modern times as a result of external domination. It must be remembered that no understanding of Islamic sciences is possible without a comprehension of Islam in itself, the life-giving force of a vast civilization, one of whose fruits is sciences. These sciences did not come into being accidentally among people who happened to be Muslims, but were produced in the form that they were produced because those who brought them into being were Muslims and breathed within an Islamic context. What was the real cause, the incentive that transformed these nomadic backward people through a religion into a global civilization? Central to this push or this catalyst, I believe, was a desire to gain a deeper understanding of the world of God, of the world of the Supreme Being of Allah. In Islam, religion and science did not go their separate ways. In fact, the former provided one of the main incentives for the latter. Faith provided an incentive for science. Science is knowledge, and Islam placed great stress on the acquisition of what it called ilm, or knowledge. To reflect is really the scientific spirit, which leads to deep understanding and discovery about the creation, and all creation is considered an artwork or a signature of the artistry of the grand artist. The Muslims did not confine the application of the teachings of Islam to religious activities, but applied it to every field of existence. Thus, a spirit of inquiry developed, which exhorted Muslims to explore and explain both the realm of nature and that of the human being. The whole central theme of Islam, of Tawheed, which we dealt with in session 2 of the SBS 318 course, pointed to human beings' place in this grand scheme of things as a creation amongst other creation. And also analyze the relationship between creation and creation and creation and creator. And therefore, the emphasis of knowing oneself and knowing the world around you and getting to know the creator through our knowing ourselves and the knowing of one another was tremendously emphasized in Islamic texts. In fact, the Quran is replete with verses inviting human beings to use intellect, to ponder, to think, to reflect. And the goal of human life is to discover the truth, not only what we call religious truth, but truth, realities. And also, at the same time, the implementation of goodness. Numerous sayings that have come down to us exhort, seek knowledge even from cradle to the grave. Seek knowledge even if it be in China. Seeking of knowledge obligatory upon every male and female, and so on. These indicate, and have been echoed throughout the history of Islam, incited Muslims to seek knowledge wherever and whenever it may be found. During most of its history, Islamic civilization has been witness to a veritable celebration of knowledge. That is why every traditional Islamic city possessed public and private libraries, and some cities like Cordoba in Spain, Baghdad in present-day Iraq, and Najaf in Iraq, or for example Al-Azhar in Egypt, or Timbuktu in Mali. In Mali alone, for example, in West Africa, a library possessing over 400,000 books, and this was over 700 years ago, 400,000 books and manuscripts found in Timbuktu, attached to the mosque, a library attached to the mosque, 400,000 books over 700 years ago, and many of them were manuscripts. And we can see that why scholars have always been held in the highest esteem in Islamic society, historically and even somewhat today, for scholars are seen as the inheritors of prophets. Now, when we look at the centers of learning, we dealt with the mosque and somewhat described how the mosque is the axis of the community. At the same time, we also analyzed how mosque played a great role and made a great tremendous contribution to the development of the society, to the promotion of learning and the flowering of Islamic learning, and wherein within the walls of the mosques were attached places of learning, libraries, and places for discussion. We dealt with this in a previous program, and perhaps next week we'll analyze somewhat the role of the institutions of learning that have been attached and that were attached and are still somewhat attached to the mosques in the Islamic world. There we see, for example, Timbuktu in the background, the center which I referred to in West Africa, which had housed in its library 400,000 books over 700 years ago. The centers in which the Islamic sciences have been taught over the ages have been an integral part of Islamic civilization. And it participated in its formal unity in the same way that the contents of the sciences became integrated into an all-embracing intellectual unity of Islam. From the beginning, from the outset, from the time of Prophet Muhammad, the mosque was at once a religious and a social center for the Islamic community, and also, second only to a place of worship, it was primarily also a center for learning and of learning. To this day, the Quranic schools, which were the fountainhead of all Islamic civilization and sciences, where the Quran is taught to the young, are still connected in many parts of the world to the local mosque in various cities in the Islamic world. Historically, they gradually developed a distinct institution called madrasa, which means literally the place of lessons or a school, which grew alongside the mosque and up till today is still closely associated with it. Then as teaching became formalized and extended, buildings and extensions were often erected specifically for teaching purposes with the mosques attached to them. And we'll see in Islamic history, sometimes, very often, mosques that had schools attached to them, and very often schools that have mosques attached to them. Even in contemporary American society, we find this trend where schools and mosques are found in one location. In either case, however, both architecturally and intellectually, the mosque and the madrasa have never been dissociated from each other. And some of the greatest Muslim centers of learning, such as Al-Azhar, even now, is both a mosque and a school, reflecting the profoundly religious character of learning in Islam. The madrasa developed into a full-fledged university. And there we have a picture of Al-Azhar in Cairo, where sciences have been taught over 1,000 years and still continues to be taught. Al-Azhar in Egypt, in the background that we see there. The madrasa developed into a full-fledged university around 1,100 years ago. A university in which a variety of subjects, from religious law to astronomy, were taught regularly. Some of the earliest Islamic educational institutions dating from this period of Genesis, in fact, still survives, an example of what we see there. And the best examples, of course, are perhaps the one in West Africa, Qarawayin in Fez, Zaytuniya in Tunisia, the Al-Azhar, which we are looking at there in Cairo, Qum and Mashhad in Iran, in Samarkand in Central Asia, in Najaf in Iraq, Lucknow in India, and of course, Cordoba in Spain, of course, not at the moment, but Timbuktu in Mali as well. So all of these belong to the later period of Islamic history, but are profoundly connected to the mosque and connected to the idea of learning being an integral part of the mosque. Now, as Islam spread, the leaders, Muslim leaders, the Khalifas, attracted to their courts people of science and letters, poets, physicians, philosophers, whom they supported financially and otherwise. Differences of creed was no barrier. Learning progressed, and learning and sciences developed. Primarily, the mosque served as the basic educational institution of the community. And as we said, as the demand for learning grew, the madrasa, or the school, or the kulliyah, the college, where various sciences were taught, or the jami'ah, the gathering, where all the sciences were taught, or the university in English, were established. And even, for example, some of the habits and practices that we have today, for example, the idea of having a chair at a university, a chair for a particular department, comes from the idea of a kursi, where the scholar would have a particular seat and teach the students around him. And that idea of the chair of the teacher is now used even in Western world as idea of chair for particular studies, where an authority is the head of that department or that section. Or, for example, the idea of capping, where the scholar would, for example, remove a scarf or from his neck or around him and put a turban around the head, indicating that I feel that you are qualified now to go out to the world and teach others as well. And of course, the idea of license to teach, what we call licentia tosenda in Latin, translated as a doctorate, is the same as what we had in Arabic, ijaza at tadris, the permission now to teach. I see we have a question here from Susan. Thank you, Susan, for the call on the question on the internet. During the Golden Age, what was the extent of the sharing of ideas between Muslims in the Middle East and Muslims in Africa? An excellent question, excellent question. Of course, Susan, if you will recall, and I think it's an excellent question, I will be referring to that somewhat later in the next portion, as well as next week. But the idea is that the students, the scholars, were at various parts of the world. And wherever Islam spread, the mosques had the great scholars, and the established mosque specifically, which had institutions of learning attached to it, had great scholars, and people from all over the world would travel. For example, many of the centers of learning were in Africa, Egypt. The first universities established in the Islamic world were all in Africa. West Africa, where the Qarawiyyin, or Fez, which is in Morocco and Tunisia, or Timbuktu in Mali, or Egypt in Cairo. These were the first real centers of learning. So we need to understand that, of course, there was that link. The other question that she's asking, or is another question here on the internet that we have, what was the role of Muslim women during the Golden Age? Were any of them great teachers or scientists? Yes, certainly they were. Of course, not only were they Muslim scholars, as you'll see, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, one of the main translators of the works of Greek writers into English, for example, was not a Muslim, for example. And so on. And of course, there were a tremendous amount of scholars, male and female, Muslim and non-Muslim, who contributed tremendously to this. In fact, next week, in the session 9 of the SBS 318 program, I would like to deal with some of the great men and women who contributed to the Islamic civilization as a whole. Now, when we look at the idea of Islamic civilization, and as I mentioned early on, it must be remembered that Islamic civilization, and any civilization, does not grow or develop in a vacuum. You borrow from the past, you learn from the past, and it's on the shoulders of the previous one that you establish somewhat of a foundation to look beyond. And we need to understand that very, very clearly. And that brings me to the next topic of the integration of the sciences. As Islam spread northward to Syria, Egypt, and the Persian Empire, it came face to face with the sciences of antiquity whose heritage had been preserved in centers which now became a part of the Islamic world. Alexandria in Egypt, northern Egypt, North Africa, had been a major center of sciences and learning for centuries, even before Islam. Once Muslims established the new Islamic order, they turned their attention to these centers of learning which had been preserved and sought to acquaint themselves with the knowledge taught and then cultivated it in them. They therefore set about with a concerted effort to translate the philosophical and scientific works which were available to them from not only Greek and Syriac, which was the languages, or which were the languages of Eastern Christian scholarship, but also from Pahlavi, the scholarly language of pre-Islamic Persia, and even from Sanskrit. Many of the accomplished translators were Christian Arabs, such as Hunayn ibn Ishaq, was also an outstanding physician, and other Persians, such as Ibn Muqaffa, who played a major role in the creation of new Arabic prose, style conducive to the expression of philosophical and scientific writings. The great movement of translation lasted from the beginning of the 8th to the 9th century, beginning of the 8th to the end of the 9th century, reaching its peak with the establishment of what was called the Baytul Hikmah, the House of Wisdom, under the Khalif Ma'mun in present-day Iraq. The resultant effort to confront the challenge of the presence of various philosophies and sciences of antiquity and to understand and digest them into its own terms and according to its own worldview was the translation of a vast corpus of writing into Arabic. Most of the important philosophical and scientific works of Aristotle and his school, much of Plato and the Pythagorean school, and the major works of Greek astronomy, mathematics, and medicine, such as Almagest of Ptolemy and the Elements of Euclid, and the works of Hippocrates and Galen, were all rendered into Arabic. Furthermore, important works of astronomy, mathematics, and medicine were translated from Pahlavi and Sanskrit. As a result, Arabic became the most important scientific language of the world for many centuries and the repository of much of the wisdom of the sciences of antiquity. It must be remembered that the Muslims did not translate the scientific and philosophical works of other civilizations out of fear of political or economic domination, nor did they consider these forms of knowing as un-Islamic. Rather, Muslims made them part of their worldview and began to cultivate the Islamic sciences based on what they had translated, what they had analyzed, criticized, and assimilated, rejecting what they believed not to be in conformity with Islam and accepting the vast corpus which was in keeping with the principles of Islam. I think that before we go further, I'd like to have us look at a snippet from the Islam Empire of Faith, a short section looking at the integration of sciences. And thereafter, we will further comment on that.
Scholars were dispatched across the empire to locate as many ancient texts as possible. The first international scientific venture in history. Unlike their Christian counterparts, Muslim thinkers saw no insurmountable contradiction between their faith and the laws governing the natural world. So they embraced Aristotle and Plato, writers the Christian church considered blasphemous.
So this is the time when we begin to see scientists, bureaucrats, what have you, going and seeking from whatever civilization that had any sciences before, be it the Greek, be it the Indian, being the Persian and so on.
From the Hindus came mathematical concepts that guide us today. It was the scholars of the House of Wisdom who developed the system of Arabic numerals, still in use. It is they who translated and transformed the writings of the Greeks and made a gift of them to the modern Western world. The Renaissance had its beginnings in Baghdad.
They managed to assimilate quite a lot of the rich legacy of the Hellenistic world, translated into Arabic initially, which was then made available to all other participants in the new Islamic civilization. Arabic emerges as the language of learning throughout the region. This is a very significant development in human intellectual history.
Having amassed the knowledge, the Muslims now began to challenge it. This was perhaps their most important contribution. The scientific process was born.
They wanted to know why a very intelligent Greek scientist, whose text they were just admiring and they were verifying it, why would he make a mistake in the first place? So they began to dig. Was it because he didn't have the right instruments, or is it because he didn't have the right methodology to use the instruments for the verifications of observation? It is this spirit. You see, the spirit of questioning, the spirit of saying that we have to build science constantly on a systematic, consistent basis, where we make a physical proposition of how the universe ought to be run, and the mathematical representation of that physical universe ought to match. Now you begin to have what I call the birth of the new Islamic science.
Algebra and trigonometry, engineering and astronomy, countless disciplines integral to our lives today trace their roots to Islamic scientists.
That was an extract from Islam, an Empire of Faith, regarding the integration of sciences, a comment by the professor, and also a report on somewhat an insight into somewhat the integration of sciences and how Islamic scholars were able to give birth to new sciences by studying from the old, integrating them, and then of course further enhancing them. We have a question here on the internet. Who were the teachers and students in Africa? Were they local teachers or did they come from Mecca? No, the teachers did not come from Mecca, by the way. It must be remembered that the fact that I mentioned earlier on that the Quranic teachings and the prophetic tradition exhorted people to seek knowledge. In fact, even the earliest revelation, the first revelation in the Quran, makes reference to the idea of learning. And therefore, it was not because Arabs taught the African or the other Middle Easterners about science or taught them Islamic sciences. And in fact, to the contrary, many of the greatest scientists, travelers, explorers, geographers, historians have been either African or Middle Eastern, but not necessarily Arab. Many of them were from Central Asia, from what is now the areas of formerly controlled by Russia, the central states, as well as Persia, what is now Iran, Iraq, somewhat in North Africa, tremendously North Africa, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, Mali, and so on. So many of the great scholars of Islam, the vast majority of them, in fact, were non-Arabs, by the way. So it's not to say that people who learned about Islamic sciences learned it from people who came from Mecca or from people who were necessarily Arab. Yes, there were great Arab scholars too, by the way. There's no question about that. But wherever people were, whether it was in Africa, with African teachers, and people from other parts of the world, even from as far afield as the East, Far East, would travel even to Timbuktu. There's evidence of scholars that they came from India, even in those days, to Timbuktu and study under the scholars there. So we need to understand that it was not Arab scholars who taught Africans or the like, but it was the scholars of that area themselves who were imbibed. There's a catalytic reaction to the injunction of the Quran and the prophetic tradition to study and to learn. And that is why you found a tremendous amount of growth in scholarship and learning and the observation of the world around them, analyzing it, criticizing what has been said before, and trying to see within the worldview of Islam how things fit in and how the creation is essential amongst other creation and how it reflects the majesty of the Creator. So we need to understand that. Yes, the other question, we have another question, we have many questions on the internet today. As Muslims integrated sciences, did they include social sciences too? And how did they apply that to the day-to-day life? A very good question. Of course, when we speak of sciences, we're not speaking only about the natural sciences. We're also speaking about the social sciences, the idea of psychology, sociology, and so on. Though, of course, these sometimes terms and terminologies may differ. And you find that there may have been studies of particular things, but the framework or the reference which we give to it today may not have been used. The vocabulary used may not be the same, but certainly the whole issue of ruling and how to deal with people, civil society, and this has been, and these kinds of questions and issues have been central. How to deal with people, people who are mentally affected, people who are in a political context, who may have differences and problems. So, as well as the issue of human beings as human beings, social interaction and so on and so forth. So, the social sciences themselves were highly developed. But of course, it must be emphasized, specifically in the field of mathematics and of astronomy and of history and of exploration and so on. These were the fields in which the golden age of Islam really established its dominance more than the social sciences. Another question here. It seems that Islam gave much to civilization in the golden age. Is the same spirit of free thinking and free inquiry part of Islam belief today? Yes, certainly still part of Islamic belief today. Islamic belief is Islamic belief. Same principles. Whether the Muslims are living up to that, that is another problem, another question. You know, whether Islam encourages the spirit of inquiry, certainly it does. Is Islam still the same Islam of that time? Yes, it still is. Are the Muslims still the same and are they living up to that? That is something that needs to be analyzed. I believe not. I believe we are not really at the forefront. And one of the problems I think that the Muslims encountered, and not only Muslims, but generally in the colonized world, that the colonized world somewhat were supreme in their own way before they were colonized. They were authorities and they were established communities with established centers of learning. Once they became colonized, somehow, obviously, the effects of colonization and those who study it would know the tremendous detrimental effect it had on the society, on the governance of that country, of the people, as well as the institutions of learning. Very often the learned people were removed, sometimes even the leadership were executed and so on. So we need to understand that. And much of Africa, not only Islam or the Muslim world, if we look at the generally at the part of the world that has been colonized, that have been subject of colonization, have suffered tremendously, and somewhat are trying to regel and rebirth to the old heritage and try to go back to the ancient glory somewhat, to the past glory. And I think that as time has gone by, and with the development of what we call the global village, I don't think civilizations will now be able to develop independently, but we'll have one civilization which is interdependent. The only problem that I encounter is that somehow, and this is the reason why I'm so keen on this particular aspect of the program, is that we must not consider ourselves mutually exclusive, that Islamic civilization was the only civilization, or that Greek was the only one, or the Western one is the only one, and that everyone is hostile to the other. We need to understand the civilizations, by their very nature, civilize and lead one another towards greater civilization. When we exclude any civilization, we exclude part of our heritage. So we need to understand that. I think this is that's very important. The spirit of free thinking and free inquiry is very essential to the development of Islamic thought and of thought in general, and of civil society and of civilizing the civilizing process. It must be I must confess that I think that the spirit of free inquiry is somewhat there, but free thinking is not as is much more restricted, I think, now than it was perhaps in the Muslim world in the past. And I think part of the reaction towards colonialism and this idea of withdrawing inwards and being suspicious of the outward world has somewhat caused a barrier. But I think as time goes along, and as we allow to acknowledge one another as interdependent, that we are intertwined, that our destinies are intertwined, I think in that way there'll be more the flowering of civilization and the contribution of various cultures and civilizational heritages that could foster better relationship and the spirit of better inquiry and cooperative free thinking. Now, we have a question on the line. Go ahead, questioner.
My question is, what is the role of slavery in the Golden Age, or even in the modern age, in Islamic culture? I think that, as near as I can tell, it's an important economic aspect of the Islamic economic system. It seems as if all of this scientific work didn't really move towards making each human valuable or each human independent. And even today, as I understand it, slavery is sanctioned and even practiced in, say, Somalia and other Islamic states.
Thank you, Chuck. I think it's fading in and out. Yeah, I think the part of the question is dealing with slavery. It's not directly linked to the topic, but nonetheless, I think the idea was, I think, if civilization, if Islam led to this great civilization of liberation and so on and so forth, of thought and of development, how come it did not lead to the to the freeing of slaves as such? I think we need to understand, once again, the idea of the context in which Islam evolved. Islam evolved in a particular historical context, and I made tremendous amount of reference to this and discussion about this, I think, in program session number 5 or 6 regarding that issue, and I dealt with this somewhat. But to answer the question in particular, yes, slavery was a reality in the Prophet's lifetime. And if Islam made every effort to find avenues in a society where slavery was predominant, which was existing, by the way, and turned the idea of and keeping people enslaved to trying to find ways of freeing them, not only by the term freeing people of slavery, but also in many different ways. I mean, you look at what happened to many of the people who came here from Africa, from West Africa. They came here as slaves. And they came here in ships called the Good Ship Jesus and Holy Mary. For example, the greatest people of our legacy, the people of peace and of love, and so on, acknowledged both by the Christians and by the Muslims, in their name and the guise of a corrupted, I suppose, form of Christianity, but people were brought here and enslaved from West Africa, many of whom were Muslim, by the way, as Alex Haley proves in his book. So I think if it's practiced anywhere, whether it be Somalia, and of course, a tremendous amount of exaggerated stories about in Sudan, if it's happening, it's happening, and of course we condemn that. But at the same time, slavery is condemned and slavery is forbidden. When it was an initial process, when it was there, of course it was dealt with, and Islam tried to find every avenue to try to free people from slavery. And you are correct in the sense that if it was able to civilize society in such a great way, how come within that civilizational heritage there are still people who have slaves? That is a question that boggles the mind. I don't think Islam should be held responsible for that, but rather Muslims who do that kind of thing. I think that they should be brought to task. And as the second caliph of Islam said, who are you to enslave people when their mothers bore them free? Now, to conclude with a section on the integration of sciences, I think we need to understand that Islamic science came into being from a wedding between the spirit that issued from the Quranic revelation and the existing sciences of various civilizations which Islam inherited. Now, before the rise of Islamic, so-called Islamic sciences, many civilizations had come and gone and produced sciences of various domains of reality and with different orders of perfection. And the two outstanding, what we call river-based civilizations of Egypt and Mesopotamia had already produced medicine and mathematics of extraordinary quality even before the Greek philosophers came. And after the Greeks, of course, in the Greco-Hellenistic tradition, before it was transmitted to Islam, there was the Golden Age in Alexandria, which I referred to early on. And the rise of Islam, and it borrowed tremendously and benefited tremendously from Alexandria, which under Islamic rule was still a major center of intellectual learning, but more so a center from which Greek and North African learning was able to be transmitted to this new civilization. Islam became heir to the intellectual heritage of the major civilizations before it, maybe with the exception of the Far East, but nonetheless, it was tremendously influenced by all of them. And the actual process of the transmission of the sciences of ancient civilization from languages such as Greek, Syriac, Sanskrit, and Pahlavi into Arabic is one of the most remarkable instances of cultural transmission known to human history. The inner need to know, in conformity with the Gnostic nature of Islamic spirituality, the young and extremely virile civilization of Islam channels its energies into the vast enterprise of translating, establishing well-known academies, and the idea of inviting scholars from all over and the dissemination of the knowledge. The translation of the majority of important scientific works of antiquity into Arabic within a period of about 150 years, stretching from the 8th century to the 10th centuries, was by no measure a mean task, or a small task. It was a massive task. Thanks to such masters of translation as Hunayn ibn Ishaq, and to the concerted efforts of various great contributors and guardians, and some of the caliphs, that some of the scientific works of Hippocrates, Aristotle, Euclid, Ptolemy, and Galen were rendered into Arabic. An eminent Harvard scholar, Professor George Sarton, traced the roots of Western intellectual development to the Arab tradition. He criticized those who argued that the Arabs were industrious imitators, claiming that those who held that thesis were holding on to something that was worse than a lie. And he wrote, and I quote, "The most valuable of all, the most original and most pregnant works were written in Arabic. From the mid-8th to the end of the 11th century, Arabic was the scientific, the progressive language of humankind. During that period, anyone wishing to be well-informed and up-to-date had to study Arabic." Now, the fact that direct transmission of knowledge was occurring, and that Europe was adopting the new inventions, discoveries, and methods of investigation can still be decoded today. to simply reflect that the vocabulary used in many sciences will still reveal the Arab debt. In mathematics, for example, algebra, the very word algebra came from a work of Jabir ibn Hayyan, which was called Hisab al-Jabr wal-Muqabala, from which the word algebra has come. Alcohol or elixir, both of these are Arabic words. The aorta or aorta, an Arabic term. Even some terms, the atlas, which is the atlas which we use, or even some of the food that we eat, or garments that we use, cotton, qahwa, or coffee, limoon or lemon, magazine or the magazine that we read, rice for the word rose that we have, safari, which is to journey, from the word safar in Arabic, or even the word sukar, which is sugar. These are still words that are used in the English language and as integral part of the language. And of course, these are words of Arabic descent. Arabic then became the most important scientific language of the world, according to Professor George Sarton, and for many centuries. And the ground was prepared thus for the rapid growth of Islamic sciences. The translation provided what they call the primary material upon which the Muslim mind pondered, and which it molded into the substructure for the Islamic sciences that soon came into being as a body of knowledge, at once distinct and at once related to the age-old intellectual tradition which it had inherited and adopted as its own. Don't go away. I'll be back after this break, and we'll be having the guest and, of course, dealing with Islamic contribution to civilization. Thank you very much. Welcome live to Calcet University, Domingo Hills, at the SBS 318 Islamic Culture and Civilization program. I'm your host and your instructor, Sadullah Khan, and we are dealing with session 8 of Islamic Culture and Civilization. Today we are dealing with Islam's contribution to global civilization, part 1. And we have been dealing with the general characteristics of Islamic civilization, as well as the flowering of Islamic learning and the evolution of science, together with how Islam was able to integrate sciences and benefit from the past civilizations, and of course build upon that and contribute to the global civilization as a whole. We have with us a guest, once again, a dear friend of ours. He's pursuing his PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA. We have with us our guest, Munir Sheikh. Welcome, Munir. How do you do?
Thank you for inviting me back.
Well, good to have you. We had such a positive response the last time. In fact, I was hauled over the coals for not giving you enough time. So I'm giving you 2 hours today, Munir.
Great. Well, let's see how we can address this issue further.
Yes. One of the, I was dealing with the question of civilization. And one of the, of course, the whole cause is Islamic civilization, Islamic culture and civilization. One of the questions is, how do we understand the term civilization itself?
Sure. I mean, obviously, before even getting into any serious discussion about any civilization, it's always a good idea to kind of step back and take a look at where such terms come from and how they might be understood. And usually the term civilization reflects it's used to describe a group of people who have achieved a certain state of technology or a certain form of governmental organization or economic organization. And usually civilization first arises in most historical narratives in the Babylonian period or the Egyptian period, several thousands of years before perhaps the Greeks that we know, who also had their particular civilization. And then you have various empires such as the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, and then subsequently with the advent of Islam, then you have a particular community of believers who have certain values and certain cultural attributes in terms of language and customs and things like that. And so that eventually also provides the basis for what we are calling Islamic civilization. Now, civilizations, as I said, exhibit certain characteristics which are related to the kind of language that is prominent, or languages, certain customs, forms of government. So within the Islamic civilization, there are very specific, unique forms of government, customs, language, and then also science and arts reflect the overall ethos of that particular group of people and their worldview and their outlook. Civilizations are porous entities, so they're not things that are hermetically sealed. And one of the things that I think we're discovering in the course of this particular segment is that you're describing the growth of science and learning within Islamic civilization and then its ultimate effect on other civilizations. So that's simply a reflection of this porous nature of civilization. And at, of course, at the beginning stages of Islamic civilization, you have the same kind of inward intaking process of information and ideas from other civilizations that preceded the Islamic civilization.
Greek, Roman, and so on.
Exactly.
And so how do we distinguish between civilization? I mean, how do we distinguish between these?
Well, as I said, each of these civilizations, if we identify certain particular characteristics of them, we can kind of isolate them in terms of their cultural patterns or certain preferences. Now, you may find analogous structures in different civilizations. So if in one civilization there's a, let's say, a quest for justice, and that's reflected in a certain kind of lawmaking that takes place, you might find that in another civilization, a parallel civilization, a similar quest for justice and other kinds of structures, governmental or legal structures in those civilizations that seek to accomplish the same thing. But nevertheless, their outward appearance, as far as our kind of understanding or analysis, mm-hmm. may appear to be different. Okay. And so those are some of the ways. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up for us to think about is that it's easy to think about civilizations in a historical sense. We can talk about the historic Islamic civilization, which, you know, has its particular characteristics. We can talk about Chinese civilization, Indian civilization, European civilization, African civilization. I think in the modern period, it's much more difficult to do that. I think that it's easier to talk about cultural domains in the modern period, where you do recognize different cultural groups and different cultural practices throughout the globe. But it's very difficult to isolate civilizations at this point in time, because the nature of communications in our modern period, the nature of transportation, people are able to interact with each other much more fluidly than they were able to, let's say, 500 years ago. So this has created a new situation in which there is no isolated civilization or relatively isolated civilization, as may have been the case in the medieval period. So I prefer not to use the term for a modern context, although it still has its uses when we're talking about historical entities such as the Islamic civilization, as we're doing.
One of the things is that we need to understand very clearly, though there may have been great periods of Islamic civilization or Greek civilization, it does not mean that everyone or that period reflected the best of Islam in itself. Mm-hmm. It may be in those periods that there may have been a flowering of sciences, of great scholars who were able to produce, but there could have been tremendous amount of political upheaval, mm-hmm. political injustice. Very often there were caliphs who were very brutal and ruthless, yet they were great scholars at that time. Mm-hmm. So the scholars contributed to the civilization, not necessarily the caliphs. And there were times there were caliphs who promoted the idea of learning as well. So, you know, there needs to be a clear distinction.
Absolutely.
The golden age in science doesn't necessarily mean that the rulers were always good and pure and upright. Mm-hmm. We have a call on the line, if you may. Please go ahead. Go ahead, sir. It's Mike.
Yes.
Go ahead, Mike. Welcome.
I'd like to know the effect of how Islamic civilization incorporated the Armenian civilization, which predated Islam, and how it affected the Islamic culture before, during, and after the Ottoman Empire.
Okay. Well, Armenia was a territory which, of course, Muslim governments had ruled at various points in time, starting in the Umayyad period. And just as Muslims incorporated the knowledge of various groups in the Middle East, whether they were Greek or Persian, Armenians would be among those various cultural groups, mm-hmm. whose texts would have been incorporated into this flowering of scientific inquiry. And specifically, I can't at this moment name specific Armenian texts that may have been translated into Arabic, for example, but no doubt certainly those kinds of things did take place, and that's simply a reflection of the kind of self-confidence that Muslims themselves had about their encounter with these, in one sense, kind of foreign elements into a new synthesis that they were creating. And I think that's a different issue than, let's say, you know, the modern period as far as the relationship between the Ottoman Empire or the end of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of modern nation states in which Armenia, you know, has a particular national identity.
Yes. So prior to the national identity as such, of course, Armenian Christians have contributed tremendously. I mean, as a historical group, I mean, historically, as a consistent people who have lived in a particular part of the world with an ancient culture, continuous culture, sure. and a distinctly Christian one as such, and a rich one as such. And I think that despite persecution, by the way, sometimes even at the hands of some Muslim rulers, there's no question about the fact that the Armenian, or even the Persian for that matter, who were not Muslim before, are now predominantly Muslim, contributed tremendously to the transmission of ancient learning and some of these cultures which were imbibed and enriched. Don't forget that it was not the Muslim people who came from one part of the world and went to the other part of the world as such. It were people in those parts of the world who became Muslim. So there were people in that area who were Muslim.
Absolutely.
I think that also need to be understood.
That's very true. I wanted to go back to your point about the nature of Islamic civilization and whether there's a role for political actors and then scientists and scholars. One of the problems that we have in our own kind of educational discourse is that we confused Islam with Muslim society or Muslim history. And we have to be very careful that we're not talking about Islam, we're talking about various historical phenomenon. And sometimes Islam gets put into that place that we're saying, well, Islam as opposed to Europe. And that's an incorrect correlation. What we should be talking about Egypt in the 10th century and, let's say, France in the 10th century, if we wanted to make a comparison,
yes.
Or China in the 15th century and Iran in the 17th century, or
yes.
Something to that effect. And sometimes Islam gets placed in that position, and that's an intellectual error.
Tremendously, I think that, and even sometimes repeated in academic circles, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
And this is unfortunate. What are some of the distinctive characteristics, you know, you mentioned Islamic civilization among other civilizations. What would you consider to be the distinctive characteristics of the Islamic civilization?
Well, I think first and foremost, the worldview of Islamic civilization is obviously predicated on the teachings of the Quran and the message and the wisdom of the Prophet Muhammad and his personal sayings and statements, which were collected by scholars. So the early scholarship of Muslims was, of course, centered around transmitting the Quran and extracting rules for the community from the Quran and the statements of the Prophet and collecting those statements. And as Muslims settled in various parts of the Near East, they encountered these various other rich legacies of knowledge in various fields, whether that's medicine or astronomy or engineering or any other field. And using the Quran as kind of a handbook and an inspirational tool, they were able to take those materials and develop the civilization, which maintained at all times this central notion of God awareness or God consciousness, and the idea that all things that exist ultimately are interrelated. And here's where you find that the disciplines of knowledge that Muslims have pursued are interrelated. In the medieval period particularly, there is no distinction made necessarily between philosophy and medicine and poetry and music.
Yes.
All of those strands are woven together in any given scholar's work. And I think that's a very unique characteristic of Islamic or Muslim scientific and intellectual activity. The quest for learning, of course, is there, and it's something that stems from Quranic teachings as well as a natural human inquisitiveness and admiration for the work of scholars who have gone before. The Muslims respected Aristotle. They respected other scientists who attempted to decipher the known world. And likewise, even the early modern European scholars such as Kepler or Isaac Newton or Francis Bacon also had a very healthy respect for Muslim and Arab and Persian scholars who were their predecessors.
Yeah.
Prior to our kind of post-colonial, post-modern world in which the East has become the other that we can't identify with. Prior to that development, European scholars were relatively comfortable with the notion that they were taking information as a natural intellectual process. from those who had simply gone before them. And that was simply a historical fact and not something that became an issue of politics or contention, as sometimes is the case in our current times.
I would like to go into the question of the golden age of Islam. Before I do that, let's take a slip from the Islam empire of faith, making reference to the period of Islamic glory in Spain. As we know, Islam ruled Spain for many centuries, and we have a snippet from Islam, the empire of faith, and then we can comment on that.
Sure.
In all the broad empire, there was one place the Christian world could experience the lifestyle Muslims now took for granted. Southern Spain. Here, on the European continent itself, Islamic culture would begin to have an effect on the European civilization around it. 1,000 years ago, the Spanish city of Cordoba was a center of learning and culture that rivaled Baghdad. Today, Cordoba's narrow lanes hearken to its medieval past. During the Dark Ages, this was the most prosperous and sophisticated metropolis on the continent. It had street lights and paved roads, libraries, hospitals, and palaces. This was a city of light, a Muslim city.
The city of Cordoba in the 9th and 10th centuries was one of the biggest and most exciting in Europe. We have descriptions of it by people coming and saying, all these flowers everywhere, this open streets, this wonderful light coming down. Northern cities were dark. Cordoba had running water. People lived in big houses. In contrast, in Paris, people lived in shacks by the side of the river.
The glory of medieval Cordoba is here, in what is now the great Roman Catholic Cathedral in the middle of town. But the Cordoba Cathedral of today began its life as a mosque, one of the grandest of the Islamic Empire.
The Great Mosque in Cordoba was simply the biggest mosque in the biggest city in southern Europe.
When you climb up into the church tower, which used to be a minaret, you look out over this expanse of roof. It's quite amazing to see this cathedral, complete with flying buttresses, popping up out of the middle of this massive mosque.
Many, many people came to visit it to view the wonders of the mosque, which had rib vaulting, the kind of vaulting which is like this, and which 100 years later, by a mere coincidence you might think, but not at all a coincidence, appears in the Gothic cathedrals of Northern Europe, in Lincoln Cathedral, in Chartres Cathedral in France. Where does that come from? Obviously influenced by the great mosque of Cordoba in the south of Spain.
For the occasional European Christian traveler, Cordoba was their one opportunity to glimpse the Islamic world. What they saw was shocking. Most of Europe at that time languished in poverty and squalor. Cordoba was a pageant of prosperity and enlightenment.
In the 10th century, there was a Saxon nun with the unpronounceable name of Hrotswitha, who called medieval Cordoba the ornament of the world. She was very, very taken with the place. And there you are, she's a Christian nun.
As Europeans made their way from the cold stone of their northern castles into the glorious Muslim cities of southern Spain, they couldn't help but be impressed. In the green hills above Granada was a palace of startling elegance, a shining example of the richness and sophistication Islam brought to medieval Europe. It is called the Alhambra.
The Alhambra is perhaps the most famous example of Islamic architecture to most Westerners. It is the best remaining example of what a medieval Muslim palace would have looked like.
Echoed in the finely carved geometric plasterwork and marble pillars is a vanished lifestyle of extraordinary luxury. The Alhambra reveals the pinnacle of Islamic culture and urbanity.
The beauty of the Alhambra is not so much in the individual details. No, it's more the combination of everything. That is, this wonderful sort of orchestrated interplay of different textures and surfaces, of light and space and water playing inside and outside of building. It's almost like a symphony of different elements that are very carefully brought together to provide exquisite enjoyment.
Here, the Muslim elite relished the good life. Reposing on lush carpets, surrounded by perfume and music, the privileged few debated the nature of God, the subtleties of Greek philosophy, or the most recent mathematical revelations from India, while they dined on spiced delicacies served on Chinese porcelains. They strolled the grounds through gardens irrigated by complex gravity-fed water systems. How far Muhammad's followers had come from the life of desert nomads. How distant they felt from the rest of the European continent they now shared. Christian Europe, due north, was struggling on through the Dark Ages.
An extract from Islam, the Empire of Faith, a PBS documentary on Islam, an excellent presentation. Reference there, Brother Munir. I think we have a question here rather on the internet. We have a lot of questions today on the internet. We have a question for you already. You mentioned cultural domains. What do you think of the idea of cultural relativism? Is it a viable way of thinking today? You mentioned cultural domains. What do you think of the idea of cultural relativism? Is it a viable way of thinking today?
That's a very interesting question. And I'm not sure if there's an easy way to answer it. I think that often in many debates that are going on today about kind of Western society and its potential to influence other societies and perhaps some sort of universal standards that should be applied to societies across the globe, this is where this issue comes in. I think historically, on the one hand, Islamic law has allowed for cultural relativism in the sense that local customs and practices were considered a source of law, in addition to the Quran and the statements of the Prophet and the consensus of scholars. So there was some room built into the structure of Islamic law to allow for cultural differences in the process of creating certain kinds of legislation or certain kinds of judgments on different issues. Now, that's just, you know, kind of an example to suggest that we have to be sensitive to cultural differences, and I do believe that that is true, that around the globe there are people who have different ways of understanding priorities, different values. But at the same time, I think there has to be a limit to cultural relativism. And I think from an Islamic standpoint, there can be a support for that notion of limits, in the sense that if human beings, according to the Islamic worldview, are all from a single source and essentially are all descendants of a primordial couple, Adam and Eve, then ultimately, despite the proliferation of cultures that has taken place over the millennia, ultimately, we all share a common essence. And on that basis, I think it's important to establish certain kinds of universal principles that should apply, whether in the realm of politics. Today we see a lot of double standards around the globe as far as different countries' policies and whether we allow certain nations as Americans, whether we allow different countries to violate certain resolutions or not, whether, you know, based on different kinds of issues. So I think obviously this has a very significant implication. Also on the issue of slavery that the earlier questioner had asked you, the universal element, I think, would also argue that, you know, within every given tradition, one can find the ingredients to arrive at a certain destination if it's a destination that is kind of universally proposed and agreed upon. And in this case, the example would be the abolition of slavery entirely. Even though historically Christians and Muslims and others have practiced slavery, that doesn't mean that it continues to that it needs to continue to be practiced, and so people in those traditions would have to find the wherewithal to argue for the abolition of slavery. And so that becomes kind of a universal approach as opposed to a culturally relative approach.
We saw the beautiful piece there, excerpt there from the Islam Empire of Faith, and they were making reference to the golden age of Islam in Europe and so on. But I don't want to refer specifically to Europe or the Islamic period in Spain as such, but just the very idea of the golden age of Islam. I'd like maybe to elaborate on that, the golden age.
Absolutely. This is another terminology that in academia we have generally kind of discarded, even though it's part of the popular discourse, the notion of a golden age of Islam or the golden age of Jewish civilization in Muslim Spain, for example. The whole notion of golden age implies that the best of the religion, and especially if it's golden age of Islam rather than perhaps of Muslims or something like that, but if it's golden age of Islam, it implies that Islam has already peaked and is on the decline. And that is a very kind of narrow way of looking at a rich tradition, whether it's Islam or Christianity or any other tradition. The fact of the matter is we don't know what the future holds for anybody, for any community or for any group. And again, Islam, like Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism, Buddhism, these are transcendent religions who have, although they are practiced in a temporal sense by human beings, they're ultimately transcendent and not connected to the vicissitudes of history. And to limit them in this way by using terms like golden age can cause some misunderstanding about the basic nature of religion. And in this case, we can talk about the state of Muslim science or the state of Muslim literature in a given time period and in a given region, and simply describe that phenomenon and leave it at that without creating on top of that some sort of framework which limits it in a certain way.
And the very fact that even if you look at Islam as a civilization somewhat, the idea of Timbuktu when it peaked was another time when Azhar peaked in Egypt.
Right.
Or when Baghdad peaked, for example, it was different. They happened to be Muslim, who were motivated by the same ideology or philosophy, but they were distinct and independent. One of the questioners asked the question that were the teachers in Timbuktu from Mecca? I said no. It may have been that people from Mecca came and learned in Timbuktu as well.
Right.
So we need to understand that. But also, I like the it's very important the point that you raised, the issue of saying the golden age almost implies that, you know, it has contributed, and almost as if it has spent its forces. In other words, not to be derogatory, not even in a derogatory sense, but implies there's nothing more to be given.
Yes.
Besides the derogatory aspect that it peaked and has gone down, the other aspect is it has given already whatever it could. And this is dangerous. I think if we look at what motivated the people in that context to be able to contribute in the way they did, could those motivations still be found? Yes, they could be.
Yes.
Don't you feel
that's like that? That's a very good insight. I totally agree.
We have another question here online. How did the East become? How did the East become the other?
Okay, I think this is a question, of course, that may fall more into the coverage of politics and other factors, because the nature of the relationship between the Muslim world or the Islamic civilization and Europe primarily is what's at stake in this question. The civilizations of Europe and Islam and China were relatively comparable as far as technology and resources in the 15th century or so. And beyond that time period, Europe, certain changes happened, certain kinds of developments took place in which industrialization was accelerated, agricultural changes took place in which the land was disassociated from the labor that worked on the land, and so there was a rise of a class of people known as capitalists, essentially. And so that created a certain kind of momentum within European society, which enabled it to become militarily more powerful and ultimately economically more powerful. One of the ways in which to justify the acquisition of new territories and new markets for the new products that were being made and the new materials that were being sold by Europeans to the rest of the world was by describing the rest of the world in certain ways, in the literature, in the public discourse of Europe. And so in that process, that intellectual process, which has been described in the work of Edward Said, for example, as Orientalism, has rendered the East as an other, as something different, fundamentally different from the civilization and society of the West, even though on the ground one may not find some sort of intractable difference. It was made to seem that way intellectually in the minds of people. And so in this way, it was more easy to justify colonial policies to essentially control other societies and to be able to extract resources. And that was a particular phase of world history, which we all are familiar with, you know, the age of imperialism, the age of colonialism, and all the various independence movements in the 19th and 20th centuries were a reaction to that colonial period, a desire for different populations around the world, whether it's Asia or Africa or South America, to be free of that colonial dominance and to become nation sovereign states in their own right. And all of this is part of certain developments at large in the world, which has led to the current political structure of our world, which is that there are sovereign nations and they represent their peoples in various ways. And that's kind of, you know, the basic simple answer, and there's a lot more to it. And intellectually, there's a lot more involved, and it has to do with the power relationships of being able to define other people and having control of language. And so when you can control language, you can render other groups of people invisible or render them incomprehensible if one chooses to do
so. Or less than oneself.
Absolutely.
I mean, the very term other implies there is a standard. The very term other implies that there is a fixed standard of which towards the rest is contrasted. So you become the mean. Sometimes a very mean, by the way. What is the significance of Islamic civilization to the world?
I think clearly from in the course of your comments throughout this program and in terms of the some of the clips that we've seen from the videotapes, the basic message is that Islam as a inspirational force, as a religion, has created an environment or provided certain means or ideas for human beings, in this case Muslims, who are taking those teachings of Islam. It provides those human beings with the means to generate new knowledge, to inquire about the world around them, to contemplate the relationship between human beings within a faith as well as among human beings of different faiths, and also to ponder the relationship of human beings to the creation at large and to their creator, to God. And so in that process, Muslims created a civilization which has, you know, its very specific characteristics, whether that's certain kinds of commerce, certain political states in various parts of the world, stretching from Spain and North Africa, in the West to what we are modern-day Pakistan and India in the East, and subsequently to Southeast Asia and in Africa. So it has created the contours of Muslim societies today. So just understanding how that developed is important as a world historical inquiry. I think what's important is that oftentimes the scientific contributions of Muslims historically are underappreciated or disproportionately appreciated in the world historical narrative. When we're talking about books that simply seek to educate all of us about the history of the world from ancient times until the present, it's a matter of intellectual integrity to give attention where it's due, to and at the proportion that it's due. And sometimes what has happened is that courses on world civilization have in fact simply been courses on Western civilization masquerading as world civilization, because many, many interesting phenomena have taken place over the centuries in other parts of the world, and knowledge is cumulative, and we in our modern time are obviously a reflection of all that has gone before, and sometimes the narrative gets skewed so that most of the interesting developments seem to have only taken place in the last 200 or 300 or 400 years in Europe. So this is, you know, obviously what we call a Eurocentric perspective that is imposed upon world history, and that's a problem. If you look at many books that are available in most of our common bookstores, and if you pick up a book on the history of medicine in the world, or the history of astronomy in the world, not the history of Western astronomy, in which case, of course, it would be justified to simply talk about you know, what we call West and, you know, the people who contributed to that science in the West. But if it's going to be a purportedly universal global history of a particular field of human inquiry, oftentimes you'll find that, you know, piecemeal chapters or token chapters are given to, you know, Muslim scholars or Arab scholars, maybe one chapter out of 15 chapters, or maybe, you know, a few pages here or there on a specific scholar.
Out of 500.
Right. And so that is simply a problem, because it doesn't give us a real accurate reflection of the cumulative development of knowledge and the true debt that early modern scholars owed to their predecessors, and who they readily acknowledged, but we don't necessarily acknowledge them. So the narrative itself gets screwed, and that is simply a cause of concern for any thinking individual. It's not a question of our history versus their history.
It's history.
It's just a matter of trying to get at, you know, the most accurate, objective understanding of how our world has come about.
Of a shared history, by the way.
Absolutely.
Specifically today, I think I mentioned in I think the earlier, in the first hour, I think I mentioned how when we deny or, you know, try to ignore the contributions that others made towards our civilization or to the present state that we find ourselves in, we are somewhat undermining our own historical background, mm-hmm. because all of these
Absolutely.
Are intertwined. You know, somewhat.
And one of the concerns that I have currently, especially in light of the current political climate and obviously the great tragedy that our country suffered in September last year, is that, you know, sometimes we have a very positivistic notion of human progress and American society or Western society, that we are always improving, we're always moving forward. Now, that's positivistic. In many cases, that may be true. We learn from our mistakes and we try to do things better. However, it's also possible to regress. There's no guarantee that we are always going to progress intellectually or morally or ethically or in terms of our policies. And one of the concerns more recently is my concern that we are regressing, in the sense that some educational institutions are reticent to teach about Islam, not teaching Islam, not as an indoctrination, because of course that would be a violation of separation of church and state, and we should not be teaching Christianity, nor teaching Islam, nor teaching Buddhism, or nor teaching atheism. We should not be teaching those entities, but we should be teaching about them. We should be explaining the various tenets, the beliefs, the practices in a neutral manner, in a dispassionate manner. And even that has come under some scrutiny by those who are reactionaries, by those who don't distinguish between this notion of teaching and teaching about. And I think that's something that we as American citizens who are concerned about the progress of our society and the enlightenment of our society, so that we'll be better prepared to interact with each other as citizens as well as interact with the rest of the world. I think we have to continue to progress in the ways in which we cover various subject matter, and obviously this course is testament to that as far as this university's desire to provide an opportunity for people to learn about Islam and Islamic history and civilization.
Yeah, that's certainly a tremendous thing, and I'm grateful to the Kelsey University, Domingo Hills, for making this platform and this avenue available. You know, one of the questions, there's so many questions, and your answers are so insightful and, you know, thought-provoking. I wanted to look at one of the questions. How can Muslims view, I mean, we find, for example, within people within the Islamic faith, sometimes I think that people within the faith tradition are sometimes less aware or have a perception that may not be accurate themselves about themselves, mm-hmm. or about what others think about this themselves, or about the history for that matter. Now, how can Muslims best view Islamic civilization?
That's a great question, and one of the things that I'm always concerned about is not only the accurate presentation of any information to our collective populace in America, but also how, because I'm a Muslim, I can obviously have an interest in trying to bring to the attention of fellow Muslims certain issues, and I'm sure you have that same kind of interest. And one of the things that I find is that, of course, Islamic contributions to science and civilization are very important, as we've already discussed, in world history as a general phenomenon, and that importance is going to remain. It's an important legacy that Muslims can take pride in. One of the concerns I have is that we should not allow the glories of the past or those wonderful developments and discoveries and innovations of the past be things that substitute for contemporary developments and contemporary advancements. Many times when there's a discussion between Muslims and others, and people will talk about different issues, Muslims will point to the fact that Cordoba was a brilliant city in the year 1000, or that Razi's developed a cure for smallpox or identified it. And those are wonderful things. Those are historical developments, but they don't substitute for fresh thinking in the contemporary period. And then this is not to say that fresh thinking doesn't go on, but as a collective discourse, sometimes I find that we use the past to make a point in contemporary times, and I think that that is not necessarily the best way to proceed in many cases.
It can be regressive.
Absolutely. Another issue that I think is important is that as human knowledge has progressed, obviously the amount of knowledge has increased to such a degree that no one person can be like the people of the medieval period, who were essentially Renaissance men, they were, and women, who were able to master a variety of fields. Most of the figures that I believe you'll be talking about in next week's segment are people who were experts not only in a specific field like astronomy, but they also many times were also physicians, philosophers,
mathematicians,
musicians, poets, mm-hmm. historians. Mm-hmm. So they were able to combine a variety of fields because, you know, the state of knowledge generally was, the corpus of knowledge was smaller, even though their intellectual capacity was just as great as of people today. But today, of course, knowledge has really exploded, and so people are essentially specialists, mm-hmm. and very few people can master more than one domain because each domain itself is
so
extremely
vast.
And that's a great phenomenon. From a Muslim community standpoint, I think it's important for Muslims to recognize the contributions that Muslims in the social sciences and humanities can make, in addition to those who are engineers or physicians or in other fields that are traditionally prized and valued. I think the very specific training that people in the humanities and social sciences receive is something that needs to be acknowledged and appreciated and utilized.
Thank you, Brother Munir. I think we have a call on the line. Please go ahead. We have Chuck calling from Woodland Hills. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah. Hi.
Welcome, Chuck.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Your previous remarks were right, very close to the question I had, which is, I guess, with time, historical errors about Muslim contributions to science will be corrected. But are there contemporary errors being made? Are there Islamic Wittgensteins that are not being discovered? Are there Islamic, I don't know, Cantors who contribute to, say, transfinite mathematics? Mm-hmm. And if there are new contributions to be made, as you were just discussing, would they really be Islamic, or would they be now contributing to sort of a new world culture, which perhaps, you know, we're all contributing to?
Okay. Excellent question, Chuck. Excellent question, yes.
I think that there are Muslims, of course, in many different fields, in medicine or in astronomy. In fact, many innovations and developments in our own space program here in the United States, many of the contributors have been Arab or Muslim scientists who happen to work for NASA or for other agencies. And in medicine, likewise, there are Muslims from South Asia and from other places who have contributed and continue to contribute in developing various kinds of technologies, like I believe one scientist developed a device to relieve the pressure on the eye from glaucoma, right, and various things like that. And I think that in the modern context, usually those contributions, Muslims themselves will take pride in the fact that a Muslim has made that contribution, but usually it's not credited to Islamic civilization at large, of course. It's simply often credited to the country from which that person is from, if it may be from Egypt, let's say, or from some other country. So I think also it's more in the context of the fact that on a global scale, developments are taking place around the planet, whether in Malaysia or in Ireland or in the United States or in any other place. Different scholars and scientists are in their own laboratories and in their own libraries making advances and hopefully getting published and being recognized in a global sense.
As a matter of fact, for example, Chuck, thank you for the question, an excellent question. The Nobel Prize winner for 1999-2000 is an American Muslim. He was born in Egypt, but of course practiced here and lived here for many years. And he won the Nobel Prize for Science in 1999-2000 was Ahmed Zuhail, who's an American, Egyptian-born, but Muslim. And the second part of the question that Chuck mentioned was, is a contribution to Islamic civilization. I just think it's the Muslim contributing to civilization as a whole, I think. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at is how Islam contributed to the present-day dominant civilization as such. And also at the same time, for the dominant civilization today, to acknowledge the fact that, you know, what we have today is an amalgamation, is a part of a synthesis of previous civilizations and, mm-hmm. and civilizational heritages and forces. And we need to acknowledge that. In that way, you know, it also creates a kind of ecumenical approach towards the future that we have, an understanding and an appreciation of one another. Mm-hmm. And that can go a great, you know, can provide a great impetus and go a great way towards harmonizing societies and communities and also motivating people to contribute in a joint effort. We're taking a break right now. We'll be back after this. We have dealt in this hour with how to understand the term civilization, how to distinguish between civilizations, what are the characteristics of Islamic civilization, what is the golden age of Islam, the significance of Islamic civilization to the world, and also how Muslims themselves can view Islamic civilization. And we concluded that with that call from Chuck, which we are grateful for. And we thank you, Brother Munir, and we'll be back with me the next hour. We'll be back in a few minutes. Don't go away. We'll be here. Make sure you are there. Thank you. Welcome back to Cal State University Domingo Hills on channel LA 36. We're coming live to you and on internet worldwide. I'm here with my guest, Munir Sheikh, a PhD student at the UCLA. And of course, we had a tremendous hour and one more hour to go. And of course, we hope to have you next week as our guest as well. And
it'll be my pleasure.
We enjoy your presence and your knowledge and information. For your information, I would like you to make reference to the following books that perhaps will aid you in having a better understanding. And of course, there are many books on the world civilization and specifically on Islam. But these three, I found it quite interesting and important, and I think a good source of reference for those who wish to inquire further about the topic and the subject. One is The World Civilizations, A Global Experience, and it is by Peter Stearns, Michael Eddis, Stuart Schwartz, and Mark Jason Gilbert. It's called World Civilization, The Global Experience. It's a book dealing with civilizations as a whole and how they have contributed throughout history, and how, of course, the one is dependent and how they become interdependent on one another as part of a global heritage. Then the other one is The Cultural Atlas of Islam by Professor Ismail Farouqi, the late Professor Farouqi, and his wife, Dr. Louis Lamia Al Farouqi. A great work on the cultural ethics of Islam, dealing with various aspects of Islamic contribution to science and civilization, and also to various aspects of Islamic history. And then also, of course, a book by Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair. Sheila Blair was one of the persons that gave a short commentary when we were watching the snippet, an excerpt from Islam, the Empire of Faith, regarding Spain in the previous hour. That's Sheila Blair. And this Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power, is a companion to the acclaimed PBS documentary, Islam, Empire of Faith. And I read from in the opening remarks in the first hour, I read portions of the introduction from this book. We have been dealing thus far with an ode to Islamic civilization. We have dealt with general characteristics of Islamic civilization and how the sanctity of knowledge and learning and the emphasis on learning itself in Islam and the intertwining of religion and science. There was never separation in Islamic history regarding that, and also how the mosque and the centers of learning were as well intertwined as was the subjects, and therefore we find the mosque and the madrasa, the mosques very often a center of learning, and very often the centers of learning had mosques attached to them, and that's why they are inextricably interlinked. And also we dealt with the flowering of Islamic learning and the evolution of science somewhat. We will elaborate a bit further on that next week, where we will be dealing hopefully with about 15 to 20 scholars that contributed, the Muslim scholars that contributed to the global civilization as a whole, and were considered some of the primary contributors to what we call the Islamic civilization. And also we dealt with the integration of various sciences, how Islam was able to integrate some of the sciences and knowledge and learning from previous cultures and civilizations, and then eventually serve as a repository and pass it on and be a catalyst for the Renaissance. In the last hour, we dealt with our guest on civilization itself, how to distinguish between civilizations, characteristics of Islamic civilization, and also how to view Islamic civilization and the significance of Islamic civilization to the world. In keeping with that, Brother Munir, I will be looking at some of the quotes that we have extracted from well-known writers and historians and analysts regarding Islam's contribution to civilization, amongst them Bertrand Russell, Dr. Philip Heaty, Professor George Sarton, Robert Briefholt, and so on. And I would like you to perhaps comment on that. Of course, our listeners and viewers are welcome to call in. You have the number as well as you have email contact. You are welcome to contact us, and please feel free to phone us as well for any comments or questions that you may have regarding the subject. The first quote that I'm looking at here is by Bertrand Russell in his book History of Western Philosophy, which was published in London in 1948. Now, on page 419 of that work, Bertrand Russell states, and I quote him, he says, "Our use of the phrase the Dark Ages to cover the period from 699 to 1000 marks our undue concentration on Western Europe. From India to Spain, the brilliant civilization of Islam flourished. What was lost to Christendom at this time was not lost to civilization, but quite the contrary. To us, it seems that Western European civilization is civilization, but this is a narrow view. Bertrand Russell, in his book, History of Western Philosophy. Kindly comment.
Sure. There's a number of interesting points that we can reflect upon in this comment. First of all, of course, the Dark Ages, you know, is often used as synonymously with the phrase the Middle Ages or the medieval period. And most scholars, of course, recognize that there's a profound difference between the condition of society in different parts of Europe, or what we call Europe now, and different parts of Western Asia, or what we call the Middle East, and other parts of Asia and Africa in the same time period. We might call that the Middle Ages or the medieval period, but again, these terms are relative to Europe. That's where these terms come from. But the important thing to note is that what happens in most Western narratives of history is that there's a selective appropriation of earlier civilizations as forming the ingredients or the predecessors of Western civilization. So Western writers historically, not so much in the present day, because academic scholarship has advanced to a certain degree where some of these ideas have been debunked and surpassed, but in the most of the corpus of Western literature, you will find this idea that the Greeks are somehow intimately linked with modern European or Western society. Now, the Greeks were a Mediterranean people. So geographically, Greece has become part of Europe in the modern period, but if you look at its cultural characteristics, it could just as easily have been categorized with maybe a common Mediterranean culture, which was, in fact, the way in which it functioned historically, or even as a kind of Near Eastern culture as opposed to a European culture. So Europe has appropriated the Greek legacy for itself, and it's also appropriated the ancient Egyptian legacy. Again, modern Egypt, of course, is part of the Middle East, and for a large part of its history in the last 1,500 years has been part of Islamic or Muslim civilization. But again, earlier periods of Egyptian history are taken into the source material of Western civilization. Now, that's, you know, fine and good, but what happens is that the major time period between the 7th century and the 16th century, in which Islam happens to be the predominant faith of people living in a certain territory, in which scientific ideas are progressing, that is overlooked and not incorporated into our telling of the narrative of history, which we've already alluded to earlier. So this selective appropriation is something that is being reflected in Bertrand Russell's commentary here, and he himself is debunking that notion.
Okay. The next quote we have is from Philip Kehity in his work Short History of the Arabs. Philip Kehity in Short History of the Arabs, and I quote what he had to say. During all the first part of the Middle Ages, no other people made as important a contribution to human progress as did the Arabs. If we take this term, that is the Arabs, to mean all those whose mother tongue was Arabic, and not merely those living in the Arabian Peninsula. For centuries, Arabic was the language of learning, culture, and intellectual progress for the whole of the civilized world, with the exception of the Far East. From the 9th to the 12th century, there were more philosophical, medical, historical, religious, astronomical, and geographical works written in Arabic than in any other human tongue. Philip Kehity in his book, Short History of the Arabs. Kindly comment.
Sure.
My task is easy, isn't it? I do the reading, you do the commenting.
It's always interesting to continue to think about these issues in new ways. Of course, as Hiti suggests, in this case, Arabs does not necessarily simply refer to Arabs in a kind of cultural or in a cultural sense or a genealogical sense. He's really talking about Arabs or people who use Arabic as their primary language, so that would incorporate Persians and Turks and Central Asians, Africans, Spaniards, all of whom use Arabic as their predominant language of communication. And of course, Arabic became predominant because the Quran itself was revealed in Arabic and it was disseminated as the Muslims expanded and settled in various parts of the Old World or the Eastern Hemisphere. So Arabic scholar in this case could also include someone like Hunayn ibn Ishaq, who was a Nestorian Christian. It could also include Thabit ibn Qura, who was a translator in Baghdad, who was a Sabaean, and Sabaeans were a group of people who are usually associated with Zoroastrianism, which was one of the predominant religions of the Near East at the time of Islam's advent. And it would also include someone like Moses Maimonides in Spain, who was Jewish, a well-known Jewish philosopher and physician, who in fact was the personal physician of Saladin's nephew during the Crusades, after he moved to Cairo from Spain. But Maimonides, a Jewish physician, wrote in Arabic and wrote his philosophical texts in Arabic and communicated with his co-religionists as well as other scientists and scholars of other religions, of course mainly Muslim, in the Arabic language. And so Hitti is simply expanding our notion of what Arab might mean in this context of learning. It really incorporates a much wider and diverse group of people who were part of a common culture and civilization that was for which Islam was kind of the underpinning.
Yes. Also, the idea that you mentioned, there were more philosophical, medical, historical, religious, astronomical, and geographical works written in Arabic than any other human tongue. It also indicates the rich legacy.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that it's at this particular time period in the 9th century and the 10th century that the technological advances that happen is really what makes this proliferation possible. There's certain paper-making technology which gets advanced. The Arabs or Muslims acquire the basic knowledge of how to make paper from the Chinese in roughly the mid-8th century. But subsequent to that, they develop that art very rapidly and make it a mass-produced matter. In the past, paper would be made essentially by hand in a manual fashion, and because of the advances in hydraulic technology, the Muslims or Arabs were able to create mills, just as there are mills for grinding wheat and other grains and things of that nature. Certain mills were constructed just to create paper, beating the wood into pulp, making flat sheets of paper, processing it in a certain way, and that mass production of paper made it possible for writers, scholars, to acquire that paper in a very cheap fashion, whereas in the past they would be writing on papyrus or on animal skins, parchment, which was very expensive.
It also made the proliferation of books more possible. I mean, the fact that there were many, much paper available. The next quote we go to is George Sarton, his tribute to Muslim scientists in his book, Introduction to the History of Science. Introduction to the History of Science, George Sarton. He says, and here of course he quotes, I quote, "It will suffice here to evoke a few glorious names without contemporary equivalents in the West. Jabir ibn Hayyan, Al-Kindi, Al-Khawarizmi, Al-Farghani, Al-Razi, Thabit ibn Qurra, Al-Batani, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, Al-Ibrahim ibn Sinan, Al-Mas'udi, Al-Tabari, Abu al-Wafa, Ali ibn Abbas, Abu al-Qasim, Ibn al-Jazzar, Al-Biruni, Ibn Sina, Ibn Yunus, Al-Kashi, Ibn Haytham, Ali Isa al-Ghazali, Al-Zarqab, Umar Khayyam." A magnificent array of names which it would not be difficult to extend. If anyone tells you that the Middle Ages was scientifically sterile, just quote these men to him. George Sarton in The Introduction to the History of Science.
Well, I think what this points to, this list of famous Muslim scientists and scholars is simply that these are the well-known figures, and we can imagine that at least 10 times that number or 100 times that number possibly were also very well-known and famous, whom we simply don't have time to list in this context, but there are many, 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 many people who are engaged out of personal curiosity and as a professional interest in various fields of learning. And so this just is a small sample of a much larger set of scholars throughout those centuries of Islamic civilization. And the other issue is that these are the people that we know because their manuscripts have come down to us and have been translated into European languages, for example. Western academics know these authors because those are the ones that were translated.
And they are referred to sometimes in the writings of some of the Western scholars in the past
right.
as well.
And what this means is that there actually are many, many other scholars whom we don't even know about because simply because of the fact that the manuscripts in which their writings exist have yet to be looked at by any scholars, whether they're Western or Muslim scholars in various countries in which these manuscripts are still sitting in libraries or in private collections waiting to be discovered. There might be some amazing treasures that haven't seen the light of day, but which may expand our knowledge of certain elements of Islamic civilization.
Now, in fact, for the benefit of our viewers, we intend to deal with quite a few of those names next week in our program. Brother Munir Sheikh will be with us. Munir Sheikh, of course, pursuing his PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA. And he'll be our guest next week as well, and we'll be dealing with some of these scholars, Ibn Hayyan, Khawarizmi. I think in the first hour, I made a mistake. I said that Ibn Hayyan was the mathematician, Al-Khawarizmi. Ratbuk al-Hisab al-Jabr al-Muqabila, from which you get the word algebra, by the way. I think it's Al-Jabr Ibn Hayyan, but rather it was Al-Khawarizmi. We'll be analyzing the life and the contribution of some of the scientists and the various sciences, and the geography and the medicine and so on. So next week, please tune in, and we'll be dealing in the second part of today's program of Islam's contribution to global civilization. And the array of names, by the way, is not only in a particular field, by Brother Munir, that you mentioned is made here. Some of them, I mean, you can. Umar Khayyam was known as a poet, by the way. He's known as a writer of quatrains of poetry. But he's also a mathematician and a musician, for example. So, as you mentioned early on, there was a diversity of, prevalent. Also, one of the things that is very interesting, you mentioned Jabir ibn Hayyan, the person who I think I may have abused. But must refer to, or refer to by mistake, Radh al-Khawarizmi. He was a student in the class of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. And in the same class of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq in which he was a student, there was Imam Abu Hanifa or Imam Malik. So and these were great theologians. So you can see there was no dichotomy between religious learning and its so-called sciences, even early in the period of Islamic history. And this is very interesting also. I think that this led to the idea that there were people who were scholars, whether there was no separation of them being theologians from them being any in other fields of science.
Sure.
I think an
underlying issue is that there's an assumption on the part of most of us, because of the fact that we live in this modern period, that somehow a rational empirical approach to knowledge is not possible from a religious frame of mind. And in the pre-modern period, when religion was naturally seen as part of existence and not something that necessarily would be imposed on one person or another person as a matter of faith, but simply as a framework for understanding the human pursuit of knowledge, religion provided a foundation for doing that in a way that did not compromise the ability of these scholars to rationally evaluate their data and try to improve their methodologies and their theories and their postulates. And I think it's important for us not to project onto the past our own preconceptions about what science is or what proper empiricism is. And I think we have to appreciate these scientists in their own context and in their own capacities.
The next quote we're looking at is that of Dr. Robert Blifeld in his work, Making of Humanity, And he said, and I quote, "It was under the influence of the Arabs and Moorish revival of culture, and not in the 15th century, that a real renaissance took place. It was under the influence of the Arabs and Moorish revival of culture, and not in the 15th century, that a real renaissance took place. Spain, not Italy, was the cradle of the rebirth of Europe. After steadily sinking lower and lower into barbarism, it had reached the darkest depths of ignorance and degradation when cities of Saracenic world, Baghdad, Cairo, Cordova, and Toledo, were growing centers of civilization and of intellectual activity. It was there that new life arose, which was to grow into a new phase of human evolution. From the time when the influence of their culture made itself felt, began the stirring of new life." Robert Blifold, Making of Humanity. Kindly comment.
Many of the scholars who wrote in the early 20th century or in the late 19th century have a very flowery way of exposition and describing what they're discussing, and certainly this kind of has that romanticized flair to it, but the underlying information, the underlying premise is in fact true, that Europe in the medieval period was largely a feudal society and very rural in its organization. And whereas most of Muslim society was very urban-based in the sense that people gravitated towards the cities, commerce was very important to the functioning of the state, the government, and of society in general. Merchant activity carried ideas from city to city in the Muslim empire, and so there was a natural connection between the commerce and the learning that was taking place, and so that contributed to the kind of momentum that Islamic civilization had in terms of this growth of knowledge in all of these various fields. And that simply wasn't the case in Europe, because structurally there were different phenomena happening in Europe. It was not because Europeans were less intellectually equipped necessarily. It's simply that the circumstances around which these kinds of intellectual activities could take place were much more rare in the European context until a later time period. We do know that from the 12th century onwards, Europeans became more and more interested in acquiring knowledge or advancing knowledge, and the best way to do that was to translate sources from Muslim authors. Arabic sources were translated into Latin by a variety of European scholars who went to various destinations. One of the most famous destinations known as a translation center was Toledo in Spain. Toledo was one of the first cities that was conquered by the Christians from the Muslims in 1085. The Muslims had arrived in Spain in 711 or in that time period and established a state in southern Spain, and Toledo was one of their important scientific centers. There were astronomical observatories there. There was a rich library there. And when it fell to the Christian forces in 1085, because of internal fragmentation of the Muslim rulers in Spain, most of that intellectual knowledge was made accessible to the Christians, and scholars came to Toledo and translated those works. And then from the 12th century onwards, those works made their way into Paris and London and other important centers, and influenced the new texts that were then developed in Europe and which ultimately led to the ideas of the Renaissance.
Yeah, what is, from what we are reading here and from what we've discussed in the past, the session so far, one of the things that I find very disturbing is, as you mentioned earlier also, this whole issue of the other. You know, for example, even despite the fact that Spain is completely European, of course, but it was also Islamic at some time. Mm-hmm. Yet the link between Islam and Spain, and Islam being European somewhat in that phase, has never, though Islam ruled there for hundreds of years, mm-hmm. There's still a, you know, Islam could be African, Islam could be Middle Eastern, Far Eastern, but it's never seen as a European for a mm-hmm. European. I mean, despite Muslim presence in Yugoslavia,
sure.
In the Balkans, and so on. And this, how do you respond to this?
Well, I think it's a bit anachronistic to talk about Europe in the pre-modern period, really. I mean, although there were notions of Europe in a kind of vague general sense, European states themselves were vying with each other. So Frenchmen had no commonality or interest in necessarily cooperating with Spaniards or British people. And there was all kinds of contention among various what we are calling European monarchs and groups, just as there was contention in other parts of the world among various competing peoples. So those were political issues, but their notion of a collective Europe was not existent at that time. Mm-hmm. It's something that emerged much later. Now, in the medieval period, Muslims, Jews, Christians all lived in those territories, and they suffered or prospered in various degrees depending on the policies of particular rulers in particular areas. Mm. So it's not really a question of looking at it from the angle of whether Muslims were seen as part of Europe or not. That's not really a question that we can ask for that time period. It's a question that we're asking today,
yeah,
because we see it that way today. So
that's precisely my question. My question is, I do understand there was no mm-hmm. notion of Europe as we have it right now, but the question is that despite that legacy of so many hundred years of mm-hmm. rule, you know, India is still seen as having been part of the colonial British, mm-hmm. colonial India, mm-hmm. as a particular period, you know, and British rule.
Mm-hmm.
So though India is not British really, mm-hmm. but they still have a kind of a commonwealth where, mm-hmm. you know, this, the idea of acceptance, the mm-hmm. acknowledgement,
yes.
that there was British dominance, there was British sure. rule and influence. The point I'm making is in contemporary society, mm-hmm. even in our contemporary thought, the way we approach Europe, Islam is seen as having something completely alien
That's
to
true.
Europe, which is not the case,
right.
neither through its civilizational heritage, mm-hmm. nor through its presence. Islam yes. was present in Spain, and it was an impetus mm-hmm. and for civilizing much of the rest of Europe. That's
yes.
the question.
That's true. I mean, I think among certain intellectual circles in Europe or even in America, that acknowledgement is growing, and you can find it in the academic scholarship, for example, that there is a recognition of the Islamic heritage that that's part of Spain. You will find that in Spain today, that certain governmental agencies or certain academic organizations will try to educate the populace about that Islamic component of their heritage. It's something that is still very much in the beginning stages, because people nowadays have a much more kind of, or a desire to be more open, whereas, and we have to keep it in the context of only in the last 100 years have nations really emerged in the way that they exist today. The Spain, you know, came out of its own civil war. England and France had their own conflicts, and only now have they gotten to a point of kind of identity and comfort level where they can start problematizing some of their ideas. Spain emerged as a very Catholic country. Its very identity was based on its Catholicism, and now it's at a point where it can no longer, it doesn't have to be as stringent in its self-definition. The people have kind of intellectually moved forward and are looking at a different way of defining their society in pluralistic terms, and that pluralism extends back into history. This is an ongoing challenge for every country and every nation. Even in the United States, we have to question and ponder about what our identity is. Is it Irish and Italian, or is it now much more diverse than that? Is it a very diverse mixture of people from many, many different parts of the world who come together and share a common set of values and agree to abide by the laws of the land? If that's the case, then that is the America that we may not necessarily see on TV, for example. So it's a question of people in a given country thinking and continuing to reevaluate what their basic essence is and what the historical elements of that essence are. And in the case of Europe, certain countries, of course, in which Muslims have lived for long periods of time, that kind of reevaluation, I believe and I hope that that is taking place. Sometimes it doesn't seem like it happens fast enough, because obviously people can be very reactive. We saw that in the case of Serbia and Bosnia and various communities in the fragmentation of Yugoslavia, that there was a great tragedy in that Muslims were slaughtered and attacked. And of course, the same thing happened 500 years ago in Spain when the Spanish monarchs essentially kicked out and converted Jews and Muslims in the Inquisition. So, you know, these are growing pains. I mean, they're very painful for us as observers to imagine how human beings were able to do such things. And that those are questions that we still ask ourselves today in a variety of contexts.
Yeah. Still ongoing in some ways.
Absolutely.
I think also one of the reasons that motivated that question, I don't know if we should belabor the point, but this whole issue, the notion of the other. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think there's this part of it that, you know, that when we don't, it's almost as if there's always been a separation, as if there's never been intertwining, as if there's never been a mixture or a it's always been a clash. Mm-hmm. And this idea of defining the other as if there's an imminent clash. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at some of the terminology being used nowadays, it seems the axis, mm-hmm. the clash, mm-hmm. these are terms that are used. And this reinforces the idea of the other. And that's why I was trying to bring up the point of the Spain, that Muslims were there for hundreds of years, mm-hmm. not for a short while,
sure.
and were ruling for hundreds of years, and contributed to the rest of what is now Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that you know that if those things can, as you mentioned, you know, be acknowledged somewhat, you know, quick enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think there'll be a better understanding of how the other actually is, has always been us,
mm-hmm. yes.
and we have been them.
Yes.
Yeah. The next quote that I have is from a French Orientalist, Dr. Gustave Le Bon. Gustave Le Bon, and I'm quoting what he said. It must be remembered that no science, either of chemistry or any other science, was discovered all of a sudden. The Arabs had established 1,000 years ago their laboratories in which they used to make experiments and publish their discoveries, without which Lavoisier, who is accredited by some as being the founder of chemistry, would not have been able to produce anything in this field. It can be said without the fear of contradiction that owing to the researches and experimentation of Muslim scientists, modern chemistry came into being, and that it produced great results in the form of great scientific inventions. French Orientalist, Dr. Gustave Le Bon. Brother Munir.
I think this reiterates the point that has been made a number of times, is that the Arab or Muslim contributions to civilization and science and learning in general are not incidents of mere transmission of knowledge from the Greeks to the modern period or to the Europeans, but rather Muslims made independent original contributions to learning, which were ultimately taken up later on by those who came after in this sequence of events. And I think that's a very important thing to underscore, that many times in the popular works on Islamic science or civilization, the credit is simply for transmitting, preserving Greek knowledge for use by some other worthy entity later on, namely European scientists. And so that's basically kind of a backhanded compliment mm-hmm. to Muslim scientists rather than a true acknowledgement of their innovative and original contributions in chemistry or in any other field. So you can extend this quote, which specifically relates to chemistry, to all the other fields in medicine, botany, astronomy, engineering, any of those fields in which for such a large period of time, 1500 years, you're bound to find advances taking place. And so Muslims happen to be situated in the part of the world at the heart of commerce, at the heart of the exchange of ideas, and were able to capitalize on that and produce new knowledge out of which the modern world emerged.
I think also he made reference to a French scientist. I think very often that as we mentioned and reiterated quite a few times in our discussion, that, you know, and not even the Muslims themselves were the inventors of everything. I mean, they took from previous civilization. And I think this idea of transmission of civilizational heritage and the acknowledgement thereof enriches all of us, and specifically in a contemporary society where we are talking about a global village, where we have all become one virtually, you know, where information is, you know, over the internet and everything, where we are, you know, virtually one as such, you know, and not distant or separate. We find ways of even going back into our history and find that somehow in history we were much more one in some ways, despite our separation, than we are right now in the ways that we define ourselves. And I think one of the challenges, I think, for our time is to redefine ourselves as a civilized people at the beginning of the 21st century. Would you like to comment perhaps on that idea of redefining ourselves? Just, I mean, whether it be American or Muslim or Muslim American or whatever it is. I mean, everybody in America is something suffix American. Mm-hmm. Everyone.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a very interesting topic, which it's very challenging to grapple with mentally, intellectually. I do agree with you that I think some rethinking has to be done across the board, in the sense that we have certain categories through which we understand the world, and obviously nationalism plays a role in creating some of those categories. But I do believe that in the medieval period or in the earlier period, people, although they identified themselves as Muslims or Jews or Christians or mainly a religious kind of affiliation, beyond that, I think from the reading that I have of history, people didn't really have other categories that they sought to impose on themselves or other people. They related to each other on a human level. Now, of course, different groups of people, based on religious law, had different privileges. So there's no question that Muslims had certain privileges in the Muslim society that perhaps Jews and Christians didn't have those same privileges. They may have had other accommodations or privileges, and in some cases they may not have been given the kinds of rights that may have been due to them based on the ideals of Islam. So those are that's again a question of a gap between ideals of Islam and practice of Muslims, which in any time period you can always evaluate that gap. But I do think that people in general were interested in a common sense of justice, a common sense of humanity, and a recognition that ultimately there is an accountability to the Creator. And we have to remember, when we're looking at history, we have to try to put ourselves in the position of the people who were living at that time. So they thought of themselves in a particular way, and so we simply have to understand that. And obviously in the modern world there are many people who also continue to be religious and believe that religion can play a constructive role in mediating between different people and different groups of people. Now, it's up to people in those faith traditions to make that possible. It's also possible to go the other way and to have a very exclusivist kind of understanding of religion. And we've discussed that in other segments. So that whole spectrum is possible, and it becomes a question of people choosing and making decisions about where they wish to lie on that spectrum. And I think Muslims and non-Muslims need to rethink their relationships and their identity, and that's what you're alluding to, and I would agree with that.
Yeah, one of the problems that I have is that you mentioned about Islamic civilization and Muslim people. One of the things that bothers me very often is that Muslims are proud of Islamic civilization, as you mentioned, of the past, and then at the same time, that is something that people are not familiar with. However, they're familiar with breaking news events sometimes, which are highlighted. Mm-hmm. And then it may be a particular group of people doing something which are maybe negative, and gets said. And the whole of the Muslim world, all of Islam, all Muslims, and anything Islamic then is somewhat, seen as being somewhat derogatory, something just backward and retrogressive. Mm-hmm. And this is very worrisome that, people are not able to distinguish a small group from the larger group. Islam from Muslims, Islamic history and legacy, and how it contributes to what we are all today. I've had many people, on radio, very, very, on numerous occasions, by the way, numerous occasions, I've heard it, these are backward people. I've heard it being said, on popular radio, and it's absolutely disgusting. Mm-hmm. So, and this is very worrisome to me that though many people are not aware of Islamic contribution to civilization, yet they are aware of some misdeeds of some Muslims. All the Muslims are guilty by association, and Islamic civilization and everything else that goes with it is swept under the carpet. It's very trying for a Muslim to be able to respond to that, because Islamic civilization is not seen. It's a particular act, and you are defined by that act. Mm-hmm. And this is quite worrisome, and it's increasingly becoming, it's becoming prominent, and increasingly so in the last few weeks that I've noticed.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is definitely a challenge. It's a challenge for the Muslim community to continue to communicate about the teachings of Islam that have been the predominant teachings, which of course Muslims would have articulated, our teachings of peace and cooperation between groups of people, and simply a desire to create a society that has some moral basis, some sense of justice, some sense of fairness. And in a global context, Muslims want to contribute to the creation of such societies, whether that be in the United States or in other places, or even in countries where the majority of people are Muslim. That is an ongoing challenge. And there are many different political factors in the world that affect whether Muslims can be effective in pursuing those goals. Sometimes they themselves can be an obstacle to the pursuit of that goal, depending on the ways in which they choose to interpret certain teachings. So it's a very complex issue, and it's hard to, in this segment, really deal with that issue other than to continue to appeal to people to look at religions in general as entities that provide certain standards, and to separate people and look at people and groups of people in their own context, in their own circumstances, and to distinguish between different groups of people. There is no monolithic group of people in any society or in any group, and there are, in American society, our own society, we have quite a spectrum of ideas and ideologies about different issues, whether it's the environment or taxation or the role of government. And there are people who are very nativist and exclusionary also within our own kind of structure of thinking and speaking and creating public discourse. And that can also be very counterproductive to the achievement of a global peace and global interaction. Ultimately, that's something that we have to kind of see ourselves on one level as citizens of any given country, which, you know, is fine and is important, but at the same time we are all citizens of the globe on a certain level.
And progeny of Adam and Eve. The last quote I have is from Robert Griffault, again in The Making of Humanity. He says, and I quote here, this is Robert Griffault in The Making of Humanity: although there is not a single aspect of European growth in which the decisive influence of Islamic culture is not traceable, nowhere is it so clear and momentous as in the genesis of that power which constitutes the permanent distinctive force of the modern world and the supreme source of its victory: natural science and the scientific spirit. Robert Briefold in The Making of Humanity. Very profound statement, I think.
Absolutely. I think this just goes back to the basic premise of the Quran, which is that it encourages reflection on the natural and known world and to investigate. Its very first revealed verse was an instruction to read. And in that verse, it also discusses that the Creator, or God, created man and taught him that which he knew not, and taught him by the pen. The pen is an instrument of technology, and it implies that human ingenuity has gone into the process of creating this instrument. And so the Quran reinforces that effort to constantly improve society and conditions through an application of knowledge. And it also ties the knowledge of kind of the practical sciences or the world around us with a metaphysical knowledge, a knowledge of the Creator, a desire to get to the ultimate essence of reality. And again, this is maybe a subject for another segment, a segment more on kind of religious philosophy or religion and spirituality. Mm-hmm. But certainly the ideas about God and about the relationship between human beings and God are intimately tied with the investigation of the known world. And Muslims will point to verses in the Quran, for example, that ask human beings to look at the way in which bees build a honeycomb, for example, and see their intricate organization and their cooperation with each other, and see that as a parable or a lesson for human beings to try to work together and cooperate. So that the very act of investigating the nature of a honeycomb will provide insight that can be applied in the human sphere. Yeah. And so there are many, many different examples like that. And I think this quote simply reflects that there is kind of integration of a scientific spirit with kind of a religious approach.
I think one of the things that he mentions here towards the end is the permanent distinctive force of the modern world, and how the major contribution was the fact that natural science and the scientific spirit, not only was, I think the whole issue of spirit of inquiry, which you mentioned, I mean, mm-hmm. and which we referred to early on as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have really enjoyed the last 3 hours, has it been? 2 hours with the Munir Sheikh. Mr. Munir Sheikh is pursuing his PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA. He has been a guest previously on the program a few weeks ago, and by popular demand, we had him back, and in fact, we'll have him next week as well, when we will be dealing with the contribution of Muslim scholars, and we're looking at particular scholars and their contribution, as well as various fields of sciences, perhaps, and categorizing the various scholars under some of those fields, if we can. Of course, some of them will just be too flexible and prolific to be put under one category. But we're looking at some of the scholars and great scholars who've contributed, and maybe commenting on that as well. And perhaps even look at some of the writings of some of these scholars, and maybe there's some quotes and extracts from Rumi or Ghazali or Khayyam,
mm-hmm.
and just reflecting on some of those statements of theirs, and to see how they enrich even human thought and human perspective on different things. As I leave you, I'll leave you with the following thoughts. As European civilization grew and reached the high Middle Ages, there was hardly a field of learning or form of art, whether it was literature or architecture, where there was not some influence of Islam present. In fact, Islamic learning became in this way part and parcel of what is called Western civilization. Even if, with the advent of Renaissance, the West not only turned against its own medieval past, but also sought to forget the long relationship it had with the Islamic world. A relationship which was based on intellectual respect, despite religious opposition. Muslim contribution helped shape this European Renaissance, which ushered in the era of what we called modern civilization. I leave you with this thought, that the destinies of the Islamic world and the West cannot be separated, and therefore it is only in understanding each other better that they can serve their own people more successfully and also contribute to a better life for the whole of humanity. Any final comments? We have about 3 minutes or 2.5 minutes, perhaps. Any closing remarks from your side, Munir Sheikh?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground generally, and I think that next week, as you suggested, we should provide some samples of some of the profound statements and writings of some of these amazing scholars and scientists. Fortunately, we have access to some of that because, as I mentioned earlier, there are translations available, and most university libraries will have the books of some of these well-known scholars, and so we'll have a chance to take a look at some of their writings, and I think that'll give us an indication that these people are at base fundamentally human beings just like ourselves, and even though they may have lived 700 or 1,000 years ago and separated from us by time, many of the things that they wrote about and the ways in which they looked at the world and human interactions and economics and social issues is not that different from the way in which we understand them. Maybe our language is somewhat different. And of course, in the social sciences, certain theories and ideas have developed in time, but nevertheless, there's a lot of commonality, and I think it's important because it humanizes the Islamic civilization and makes it something relevant and identifiable to the average person who may not have access to that information ordinarily. And I think it's important on that basis because it breaks down the sometimes the barriers that we create for ourselves or have been created for us intellectually because of various things like the things that we talked about, the notion of the selective appropriation of different cultures. So as people in the West, we're accustomed to identifying with Aristotle. We're not accustomed to identifying with Ibn Rushd, but maybe if we looked at Ibn Rushd's teachings, we would say that he is much closer to our own understanding of philosophy than Aristotle is. So I think it's important for us to have closer access to our collective heritage, and we hopefully will be able to contribute to that process next week.
Yeah, we thank Munir Sheikh, PhD, pursuing his PhD in Islamic Studies at UCLA. Wish him all the best, and of course we have been enriched, tremendously enriched, by his thoughts and his ideas, his contribution. We are thankful to him for that. And we hope to have him, and we'll have him for next week for sure, God willing, as our guest again. And then perhaps we can close the whole 3 hours, and then we can go through together, and yeah, it'll be good. And we can contribute towards that way. I think the idea of some of the thoughts of Rumi or Ghazali or Bikhayyam, we can maybe, that'll be very interesting, I think. But I wonder if it's ever been done on American TV, and I hope we can do it for the first time. It'll be something, I hope, great. I'm sure there'll be a lot of demands for that segment or video, I hope. Anyway, today we have dealt with Islam's contribution to civilization, Islam's contribution to global civilization, part one. We had our guest who was pursuing his PhD in Islamic Studies at UCLA, Brother Munir Sheikh. And we dealt with an ode to Islamic civilization, the general characteristics of Islamic civilization, the flowering of Islamic learning and the evolution of science in the process, and the integration of sciences, and tribute to Islam's contribution by various scholars. We'll see you next week. All the best. Good luck. God bless. And thank you very much for being there. We'll be here next week. Hope you'll be there. Thank you and goodbye.